one step in this long progress. It's been a team effort by us all the way. And we're but part of the whole team that's worked so hard.
The shuttle era will come to an end. But they won't stop inspiring, and they won't stop being a part of the fabric of America.
We choose to go to the moon.
Alright, and welcome everybody to another episode of the Talking Space Podcast. This is Talking Space episode 520 for the week of Monday, June 24th, 2013. I'm Sawyer Rosenstein, back again, getting there on the healthy side. And joining me as well tonight is Gene McCulloch. Welcome, Gene.
Greetings and felicitations. We got a lot to talk about tonight.
Yes, we do. And welcome as well, Mark Ratterman.
It's good to be here. And can I introduce our first comment and order of business, Sawyer?
You sure may.
I was painfully aware, having listened to the last show, how poor our audio was. And I have to confess that I believe that I was a major contributor to that. Using a completely different setup in such a way that we've never done a recording, done a show this way before. And I apologize to everybody. One thing that I'm acutely aware of is odd sounds in a recording. And every time I think I touched the desk or touched the microphone or scratched my head, I think it came through. And sorry about that, folks.
Well, you did have help. Co-conspirator here, so don't worry about it, Mark.
Right, I must add, I was unable to help out last episode as I was on the relatively very sick side. So thank you again, Gene, for taking care of the editing on that last episode. But I must apologize for the previous episode as well, the Space Fest episode, in which I know our audio, us the panelists, was, again, not the greatest that we've ever had, as we tried out brand new technologies in brand new locations and realized very quickly that it didn't work.
That's the one that I was thinking of, Sawyer. Yeah, you're right. That was two shows ago.
Right. Last week's we had a little left and right, back and forth ear action. But
yeah.
Either way, we do apologize for the poor audio in the last couple of episodes, and we hope that this one is a little bit better for you. And by a little bit, we mean a lot. And again, please, if it is not to your satisfactory liking, the audio has some issues, there's anything wrong, please, like all these other people did, contact us in any way, shape, or form. Email us, fill out the contact form, tweet us, anything. Please let us know, because we do the show for you. We want you guys to enjoy it. Now that that's out of the way, let's get started with the exciting news that we have this week, such as Twinkies are coming back, Buzz Aldrin hates Tang. Now, trust me, it's not that boring of a news week. We got some great stories, and let's start off with a little bit of heliophysics and the sun. Now, there's a new mission that's going to be launching to the sun. Most of us probably know of the Solar Dynamics Observatory, or SDO, which has been giving us great shots of the sun for the last couple years or so. But there's still parts of the sun that we don't understand. And one of those big parts is a location right between the photosphere and the corona. And it's called the interface region. There's a lot that goes on in here that we don't know about, so NASA's getting ready to launch its Interface Region Imaging Spectrograph, aka IRIS, to explain some of the mysteries of this. For example, like, why is there a huge temperature jump between the two layers? So that is scheduled to launch from Vandenberg Air Force Base on Wednesday, June 26th, and not going to be your typical rocket launch that you'd think of, as this is being launched from the Pegasus XL rocket, which is launched from the underside of an L-1011 TriStar airplane. And the company behind that, you might recognize their name, Orbital. So that is scheduled for this Wednesday, June 26th, and we wish them all the best on their luck of their launch. So this is a pretty cool mission, and again, a lot of people don't think of orbital when you think of regular, typical satellite launches.
Well, orbital sciences, the Pegasus has been around for a while. Pegasus was one of their first boosters, and it was kind of, you know, I kind of recall orbital sciences showing up at one of the International Space Development conferences and plugging Pegasus. The whole idea was to try to go ahead and keep launch costs down and so on for certain vehicles, and the scientific package that is going to be launched, the IRIS vehicle, sure goes ahead and qualifies for that. Sawyer, the science behind this, again, this is all part of the Living with the Star program, correct?
Exactly. This is part of a whole fleet of other solar satellites that NASA has. And this one, oddly enough, is going to be in, I believe it's a polar orbit.
Is there a reason for that? You know, I'm just curious, because I know this is, again, another eye on our nearest star, the sun. So we're trying to go ahead and really, really understand what's happening with it, and try to really understand the nuances of it, and making sure that that we could properly predict solar maximum periods and so on, and just basically try to go ahead and safeguard ourselves, because just recently there was a CME that got fired at us this past weekend, right, Sawyer? I think.
Believe so.
Yeah.
But so, basically, the big thing, I was at the press conference for IRIS at NASA headquarters, and besides the fact that it's reliable and it's easy enough where they can still get regular data at the same time every day, you know, it's still constantly able to watch the sun, it is less orbit, less money, to be perfectly honest, was a large part of it.
Yeah, I would figure that we're just trying to get more bang for our buck, and I guess this is indicative of what's really, really going on with the entire space program as a whole. As we said last program, I think the next budget that's being proposed is about $16.8 billion, and it's really, really going to hit some very key programs exceptionally hard. So the idea is to go ahead and try to build something that's, you know, a little, is maybe small, but it would go ahead and give a good science return. I think that's probably what the goal of IRIS is. And from what I've seen and from what I've been reading about it, I think they're going to go ahead and accomplish that. There's a very interesting video, if anybody wants to see it. It's up on the NASA website, that goes ahead and shows what the launch really is. It's a really neat animation. I guess NASA has it. Might have been furnished by Orbital Sciences. I'm not sure, but go ahead and take a look at it. It really does depict the Pegasus vehicle slung underneath the L-1011 and how the Pegasus vehicle does work and how it carries its payload up and what's going to happen to IRIS after it goes ahead and unfurls. And just like with any satellite, it's not going to go right to work. There'll probably be a commissioning period where the scientists will go ahead and take a look at it, make sure it's functioning right, and then they'll declare the vehicle operational.
Pretty much they won't start testing out the instruments till about 30 days, and they won't be fully operational until about 60 is what they were telling me.
Yeah, that sounds about average for what I've heard with a lot of the scientific and the military payloads I've heard too. There's another interesting little orbital story, and I'll just put this in on the side, because we had been following the Antares as it's been going through its development phase, when I was at Wallops Island. Just this past April, one of the questions about Antares was the availability of the first stage engines. Those first stage engines are built by a company called the by Kustinov. They have been building these engines for a while. They're called the NK-33. Their lineage dates all the way back to the N-1, if you could believe it. The supply of these engines were sort of finite, and we weren't exactly too sure how Orbital was going to go ahead and keep Antares going with the finite supply of engines. Of course, their spokesman, Barry Badesky, basically said, we'd love to have that problem, meaning the Antares is doing so healthy that we would soon run out of engines. Well, that's not going to happen, it looks like. There was an article just this past week out of Aviation Week saying that Kustinov was going to go ahead and restart the NK-33 production line so that a company called Aerojet, or now Aerojet Rocketdyne, they've just recently merged, could go ahead, take the NK-33, soup it up, and turn it into the AJ-26 engine, which is what the first stage of the Antares uses. They're just waiting to go for Orbital Sciences to give the word to start that that production line back up again. So it looks like that's good news for Orbital. As far as the Antares vehicle, it looks like its first stage engines are assured at this point. And again, good news for Orbital here again. We'll be looking at them Wednesday, and I'm sure the Pegasus vehicle will go ahead and deliver Iris up to where it should be, and it will start to do some really good science and learn more how to live with our closest star, the sun.
Exactly. Another interesting solar mission. And what was really surprising to me is how small it is. It's not that large of a satellite, especially when you think of some of the other satellites that are up there in orbit and some of the things that we've seen physically in person, us in talking space. It's not very big. It's the TV studio that I was in for the press conference. The width of it is about that big. They had the poster behind them was scale size, and it is, I don't have an exact measurement, but it's not very large, and it's going to be doing some big science, so all the power to them.
It just goes to show, in some cases, size doesn't matter. You could still go ahead and get some good, you know, bang for the buck, if you will.
Yeah, we're not talking car-sized rovers here. But again, all the best of luck to the Iris team, and hopefully by the time this episode comes out, it will have successfully launched. Alrighty then, so speaking of things in low Earth orbit, the International Space Station. And a little bit of news out of the space station from today's recording date. Gene?
Yeah, thanks, Sawyer. There's a little bit of an EVA, or extravehicular activity, or for those of you who are new to spaceflight, a spacewalk. Conducted today. It started at 9:32 a.m. this morning, Eastern Daylight. This one, however, was conducted by the Russian side of the house. Fedor Yurchikhin, there, I think I got that right, and Alexander Mizurkin. Alexander Mizurkin, this is his first EVA, and I believe this is Yurchikhin's sixth, if I'm reading this right. Now, the whole purpose of today's EVA, which lasted about 6 hours and 34 minutes, according to NASA.gov, was to go ahead and prepare the station for the arrival of a new module, basically. The Piers docking module is going to get swapped out, and with a brand new multipurpose laboratory. And this is going to be a combination research facility, airlock, and docking port, and that's going to be going up later this year. So they were just making sure the lines were in place for all of that and making sure that the ISS was prepared to go ahead and take on the new module and then jettison Piers. But there were some other housekeeping duties that the two performed out there. They replaced, according to the NASA website, an aging fluid flow control panel on Zarya, and some preventive maintenance for a cooling system on the Russian segment of the station. But again, it was looked like that the EVA went very well, and that all mission objectives on this one were done. So this is good news. It looks like the ISS is now configured, or at least the Russian side of the ISS is now configured to take on the new multipurpose module that's going to be attaching there. So good news for the Russian segment, and good news for the ISS as a whole. There'll be some new laboratory equipment coming up with that, and thus we'll be able to do some more, I hope, you know, better and better science out of the Russian segment. So good news all the way around.
Exactly, because I mean, I remember back in 2011 we were saying, you know, that the Leonardo was going to be the final piece on the space station, and Russia's like, yeah, no, we got more. So, you know, it's nice to see that the space station, even though people are talking about, oh, we're, you know, it's going to come down in 2020 and maybe 2025, that we're still like, nah, it's science. Science is more important anyway.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just if anybody wants to go ahead and take a look at this too, there's an interesting article on some microgravity research, and this is on NASA.gov, that's going on right now for fighting cancer. So if and how the immune system works and so on. So if you could go ahead and understand what's going on with these cancer cells and trying to ascertain how to deal with them. Who knows? I mean, I'm not saying that the cure for cancer is going to come from the International Space Station, but it would support that cure. Who knows? It might. So, again, the article is entitled Fighting Cancer with Microgravity Research. It's on... on the internet. It's on the International Space Station side of NASA.gov, and I'll give that to Sawyer, and we'll post it in the show notes.
And congratulations to the crew, and there's a couple of U.S. spacewalks coming up in July as well, two of them, I believe. So the ISS is constantly being updated, upgraded, and resupplied, which we'll talk a little bit more about later on in the show.
Yeah, definitely. And it just goes to show, too, Sawyer, that this is a living, breathing facility, and it will be in operation hopefully through 2020, although some bets are going on that it might go a little longer than that. So we'll just have to, you know, fasten your seatbelts, folks, and wait and see. But I'm sure that if we could still get some, you know, money out of it and still get some good research out of it, we're going to do that, so we'll stay tuned. I have a feeling there's going to be life in the International Space Station past 2020.
Exactly. You know, they say break a mirror is 7 years of bad luck. I say install a new segment, 7 more years of science. Alrighty then. So, that's 2 of the 3 people on our first trip around the table, and next it goes to Mark.
Yeah, but you know how it is. First, I got to give you some background before I get to the point of this little story that I've got for you. Let's talk X aircraft, such as the X-47B. It's a Northrop Grumman demonstration unmanned combat air system, a UCAS. It's designed for carrier-based operations. And you wonder what this has to do with talking space. Well, let me tell you some of the highlights here. This is from a variety of sources. Wikipedia gave me just that little bit of background, and here we go to aviationweek.com, where on May 4th, 2013, the U.S. Navy made aviation history by launching this X-47B off of an aircraft carrier for the first time. So unmanned aircraft launched from the carrier. They flew it around, and they landed it at the Naval Air Station in Maryland. That was pretty cool. Well, you know what happened a couple weeks later, May 28th? They missed a flight. Now, how could you have an unmanned aircraft on a carrier where everybody's focused on this test flight? How could you miss it? How about the GOES-13 satellite? Now, GOES-13 suffered an anomaly, as it's referred, in May of 2013. They believe it was hit by a micrometeorite, which caused it to lose track of stars that it was tracking to maintain its Earth positioning attitude. Satellite went into a safe hold mode, instruments turned off, and the satellite slowly turning to assure sufficient solar power. After a few days, the satellite was turned back on and checked out okay. They expected to have it returned to operations a couple weeks after the incident. Well, in the meantime, they brought a satellite out of storage, the GOES 14, and they used it for temporary coverage. And this is right at the knocking on the door beginning of hurricane season in the U.S. So it's a time where something's going to happen, and it did. We had tropical storm and nothing real significant, but you know, they want to keep an eye on the weather out in the Caribbean, the Atlantic, etc. And these GOES 13 was very important. Now, this was originally launched in the 24th of May 2006 as the GOES N satellite. It was checked out, put in on-orbit storage until the GOES 12 satellite failed, and this GOES N and renamed GOES 13 went into service April of 2010. So it ran for 2 years. They think it got hit by a micrometeorite. It required a lot of extensive communications time from the ground up to the satellite to make sure what the status was. Did they have to really be worried about it? Were they going to have to move the satellite that was in storage over to take 13's place? All of these things were happening. Well, U.S. Navy was ready to have their second catapult launch on a carrier out in the ocean. They had to have a brief stand down because of priority use of the Wallops Island facility and the risk of frequency interference between this unmanned aircraft and communications that were required to recover control of the GOES 13 satellite. So the whole point of this story isn't about the X-47B. It's not necessarily about the GOES satellite, but just the unlikely interactions that can occur between things that you and I and a lot of people would think have no bearing on each other. But here was a test flight for the military, an aircraft carrier that was tasked with probably largely doing that. Of course, every operation the military does is training exercises in one way or another. But frequency interference, now that's part of the world I live in with communications equipment for the FAA, and just totally off the wall, unexpected things that can happen with things that generate radio frequency energy. And here was something that somebody had the foresight to catch and to not put the X-47B at risk and to allow that GOES 13 to recover. And, of course, the happy part of the story is that June 10th, they did their final update on this anomaly, and they said that it successfully returned to full operational service, all operations normal. GOES resumed at that time on June 10th. They've got successful data, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So all's well that ends well, but makes you wonder just how complex this world we live in is and how many things we take for granted.
It's still fascinating to me, Mark, how a satellite could go ahead and interfere with the operations of a what is essentially an unmanned drone. Am I correct on that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, unmanned drone. Now, state of the art. You know, it's got a future in the military as an unmanned combat aircraft. But, you know, this is still the test flight stage, and they've only got two of them.
Yeah, and this test flight is kind of critical. I mean, did this mark like one of the first times that an unmanned drone was used off the deck of an aircraft carrier?
Oh, yeah.
I remember.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. First catapult launch of an unmanned aircraft.
So, you know, again, this goes to show how really, really critical this was. And in a way, I'm glad that this was discovered, because that could have went, you know, the wrong way had that not we could have UAV could have had a bad day if I'm reading this correct.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? And anybody under the flight path.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Occasionally, I joke around that people say, oh, you work for the FAA. Well, you're going to be flying to here or there or wherever it is I'm talking about going. I say, oh, no, I'm driving. I said, I said, I feel safer driving, and I don't. Flying is by far safer than driving on any highway, no matter how good and how safe you think you are. But I like to joke around with people. And in fact, I say, yeah, there's some people I know that work at such and such that I don't even want to be underneath the sky in that area because of those jokers. And again, please, I'm joking. I'm proud to work for the FAA and the people I work with and many people all across the country do a great job. And that's evidenced every so often by stories that hit the media and how they save somebody's bacon and get an aircraft on the ground that you would think would be absolutely lost, maybe a private plane, et cetera, et cetera. So enough of this unpaid advertisement for the FAA, but I do like to joke around.
This was just a really cool story, Mark. Thanks.
Yeah, sorry I wasn't right on top of it. Here we are, the end of June, and this all took place mid-May through the end of May and early June, but I thought it was interesting enough to bring it up and probably something that most people haven't heard about, so thanks for the opportunity.
Definitely. I'm pretty sure a lot of people haven't heard of it, even though it was, you know, a month ago or so, so it's always great to hear these things, and thank you, Mark, for keeping up on all the FAA stuff. I wonder how you do it.
40 hours a week makes it somewhat a little convenient, I guess you could say.
Alrighty then, so that brings us to the end of our first trip around the table. And let's start round two. And I guess that comes back to me. And while we're talking about the FAA and airplanes, and while I was talking earlier about the sun, let's combine the two. What about a solar airplane? Well, there is a company and a plane called Solar Impulse. Now, Solar Impulse made some big news, especially when it started, made some flights back in 2003. It then flew a little bit around Europe in 2011 and 2012. It made its first intercontinental hop between Europe and Africa in 2012. And this year, they decided, let's travel across America. And travel across America they did. So they started off in San Francisco, California. They then made their way to Phoenix, Arizona, followed by Dallas, Texas, followed by St. Louis, Missouri, followed by Washington, D.C., which is where it currently is, at Dulles Airport. Its next and final stop, probably by the end of this month or early July, will be a final leg to New York's JFK Airport, and that's where its trip will end. So this is pretty cool. This is a plane that is powered pretty much entirely by solar power. It's got an extremely wide wingspan, and it's just one of the coolest things that you've ever seen if you take a look at the pictures of it. And it's got a giant solar panel on the top. It's pretty freaking cool, if I do say so myself. So, I mean, this is a pretty impressive aircraft, and if you get a chance to see it while it's in New York, go ahead, because this is the last time that that aircraft will ever fly, because this thing has been going for years now, and they've got the newer, sleeker, younger version of it, which is scheduled for an around-the-world trip in 2015. So this aircraft, by the way, is called the HBS-1A, if we want to get extremely technical. So, yeah, if you get a chance to go see it, take a look at it. The pilot who's flying this, one of the main pilots at least, is Andre Borschberg, and this is pretty cool. And the other aircraft, I should add, by the way, is being built as this one was in Switzerland.
Imagine seeing something as unique as that in flight. I think that would be a... of course, I'm the one that I hear an airplane, and I have to look and see what it is. Even if it's a you know, type aircraft I've seen hundreds and thousands of times, I'm still curious and love to watch them. And what a thrill if I was in the neighborhood and could see that one.
Oh, yeah, it's got an extremely wide wingspan. It's got, it looks like four propellers or so on the front. It's got a whole array of solar panels on it. It looks almost like one of the little dart-type aircrafts that you would, you know, make out of balsa wood and throw as a kid. But it's just cool-looking, if I do say so myself. And I'm hoping that I can make a trip down to Dulles before it heads over to New York City to go see it.
Yes, sir, is this sort of this is obviously a test of concept to see if you could do an entire solar aircraft, and is the game plan try to see if they can make this practical?
that's what it seems to be. I mean, pretty much their goal is to... They came up with the first entirely solar-powered airplane. And if this technology can work, I mean, you know, it's obviously going to have to start on these smaller types of aircraft. But if this is a technology that can be worked its way into commercial jetliners, even if it's not entirely solar-powered, but just a little bit to save a little bit of energy or not have to work the APUs as hard or something, I mean, this could be a great technology. And if they can fly this thing around the world in 2015, I think that's going to say a lot about the future of solar and airplanes.
And so, again, the itinerary for this thing, it's going to be landing in New York. Is it at JFK, at LaGuardia, Newark? Did they say exactly where?
If they were to land at Newark, I would be sorry for them. But no, they are a New Jersey native. I can say that. This is coming from Dulles to JFK.
Okay.
And it's going to be sometime either the end of this month or early next month. They haven't set an official date yet. But on their website, they do have viewing locations of where to see it take off from Dulles and where to see it land at JFK. Because I'd love to see this thing in flight too, Mark.
Does NASA have a link on the website as far as where we could go to get some more info if we were interested in learning about this, about the project?
I don't think this is NASA. This is purely just a private company that's doing some cool airplane stuff. But their website is solarimpulse.com.
Okay, so go there and we'll learn more about it. I thought NASA had their hand in this too at some point.
It's not NASA, but for Institutional and Aeronautics Partners, ESA is actually involved. So it's not NASA, but ESA's got a hand in it. So,
way to go, European Space Agency. Go for it.
Exactly. I mean, there is plenty of potential. Alrighty then. We are going to fly our way back into space, except we're painting our aircraft red. Gene?
Well, yeah, sort of. The Chinese have been hard at work, too. Just to, you know, in case folks don't know, the ISS is not the only game in town up there. The Chinese have their own spacecraft up there and their own what they refer to as a space module. It's essentially a prototype space station. The crew over the weekend, or should have said last week, excuse me, did a little bit of a STEM event for middle school in China, and they took questions from students. They also demonstrated, you know, the gyroscopes, the usual stuff. This over the weekend, they went ahead and performed a manual. They went ahead, detached the Shenzhou 10 spacecraft from the module, which is called Heavenly Place or Heavenly Palace in Chinese. Don't ask me to pronounce the actual name because I will botch it. So I'm going to leave it alone. And no disrespect meant.
You mean Tiangong?
Thank you. I wasn't even going to attempt it, because I know I'd maul it. But anyway, this was part of the mission plan, so they wanted to make sure to see if the Shenzhou vehicle could go ahead and perform a manual docking with the lab. And lo and behold, it can. So everything went fairly well there. But there's been a lot of press lately about what's been going on with China and space and spaceflight and what have you. They just flew a woman on board with this particular flight here, and it's just the perception out there is that, okay, the U.S. after shuttle is just kind of lying down and playing dead, and that the Chinese seem to be a little bit more active than we are. Grant you, they are one of two countries right now that could actually launch a human being into space. Right now, the U.S. does not have that ability. We are trying to get that ability back. We are building four spaceships to do that right now. But the perception is that there's a tortoise and the hare thing going on where China is just slowly working, slowly trying to go ahead and make sure that their program is on track. We really don't know what they have up their sleeve, but from what industry watchers have been saying, it looks like their objective is to try to go ahead and build something that kind of sort of resembled the old Mir space station. They did say at one point their objective was to get some button to get a human being on the moon by 2016 and so on. In fact, Dr. Buzz Aldrin is fond of saying a return to the moon, the only thing he'll find is Chinese, so don't bother, which is one of his selling points for Mars. But I think the Chinese were taking their cue from us because we were also, if you recall, talking about at one point returning to the lunar surface to pick up the baton left behind. What I'm trying to get at is, you know, is there going to be a tipping point where China's space program overtakes the U.S. program? And so somebody posted something on the Talking Space website, just a comment with reference to that. Do you have that handy?
I sure do. How convenient. So this was a comment that was posted actually on our Space Fest episode, bizarrely enough. And this is from a commenter by the name of John Sullivan, who basically says here, quote, "The reason China's doing well in space is because our debt interest to China per year is $360 billion, 20 times the investment we same American taxpayers are making in NASA. Dumb us. And dumb all the space enthusiasts who lament we aren't catching up to China. We are paying for their space program 20 to 1. Tell Congress to balance the budget and end our investment in China's space program. For each day that passes, we go into debt at the cost of a space shuttle." End quote.
Well, yeah, I'll give Mr. Sullivan this much. We shouldn't have gone ahead and started borrowing from the National Bank of China to begin with. But the deal is the way I kind of look at the debt problem between us and China, and this is just to put Mr. Sullivan's letter in to some perspective. If you owe $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 to a bank, a big major commercial bank, the bank owns you. So if you've got a mortgage or something like that, well, in a way, the bank owns you. Now, if you own a few $1 billion to the bank, well, congratulations, you own the bank. And that's the way I kind of look at the debt problem with China that the United States has too. Because, we could, they could say, well, all right, they can knock on the door and say, okay, U.S., pay up. And we'll just say, well, we just don't have it. And, what are you going to do about it? So, when you're talking like astronomically large amounts of money, you owe that kind of money to them. You got them. They don't have you. That's number one. But, yeah, China's been active. But they've been active for a reason. And I think that reason is we've kind of paved the way for them. So has Russia in a way. We kind of went through all those growing pains some 50 years ago when we were trying to get our rockets up there and our spacecraft up there. The Russians, they had to do a lot of guessing and a lot of trial and error, just as much as we did. I mean, there were everybody kind of remembers the old days at Cape Canaveral when you'd always look up and see this thing fly off a launch pad, and about 3 seconds later it would explode. That was all trial and error. We learned what not to do. Well, the beneficiaries of that are everybody else that have come behind us, and China certainly is one of those beneficiaries. It's number one. As far as overtaking us is concerned, all right, fine. I think that's temporary. Are they doing stuff right now? Yeah. But, okay, we've got, let me see. We have CST-100 under development that Boeing is doing for the Commercial Crew Program. We have the Dragon piloted version that is also under development, again, under the Commercial Crew Program. We have a small winged shuttlecraft called Dream Chaser that Sierra Nevada is putting together. So those are three vehicles that we are currently putting together to get to low Earth orbit. We are also assembling another vehicle called Orion, which will be a true deep space exploration vehicle. We're still trying to figure out what we want to do with Orion, but we will have this capability. Are the Chinese really overtaking us? Well, no, there's a lull between the storms. That's one. That's on the piloted side. Now, okay, the United States has been to the moon. Our footprints are there. Our flags are there. Our equipment is there. China has not done that yet, nor have they really duplicated that. I understand they may try to do it, but, you know, who knows, really? In a closed society, I really don't know what's going on. The Chinese program is a product of their military apparatus. NASA is essentially a civilian-run agency. So you kind of see where that's going right there. We've been to Mars. We have two robotic vehicles that are roaming the surface of Mars. We have I don't know how many robotic emissaries out in the solar system right now, everywhere from Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 to New Horizons to Cassini to everybody, to everywhere, really. So I can't really, I'd be here all night trying to name them all. The Hubble Space Telescope has become a cultural icon. It will soon be usurped by the James Webb Telescope. So to kind of sort of say, China is overtaking us, I kind of sit there and go, okay, fine. They may have an edge for the moment on the human side of the house. Right now, the United States cannot launch its own citizens into the void. And I had a little bit of a debate over the past week with somebody saying, okay, fine, big deal. It's cheaper to pay the Russians. And I'm like, well, yeah, but right now all our eggs are in the Soyuz basket. It's good to have at least a few choices to get to the International Space Station or anywhere else. But I guess really the whole point is China's not overtaking us. And I thought Florida Today's John Kelly had a very interesting article about that, and I think we'll have that in the show notes, as far as the Chinese being still very, very far behind. I tend to agree with him in some of the points that he's made. Now, he doesn't belittle the achievements China's made, and they have been big. And believe me, I'm not going to belittle them. I mean, the Shenzhou, yeah, okay, fine. It's a sort of a prototype of the Soyuz, but it does a little bit more. In fact, the orbital module can sort of be left behind, if I'm not mistaken, if they do decide to do that on their space station. So if they want to expand it, they could instantly expand it by, you know, leaving that orbital module sitting there. Would it have that particular docking port there? I don't know, but it's a nice little piece to have there if you ever want storage or something like that. So it's something that the Russian Soyuz cannot do. So again, it's a little bit of an upgrade to the Soyuz design, but I'm not going to belittle what China's done in space thus far, and it is impressive. But they're kind of riding on our coattails a little bit. We've kind of paved the road for them. We've done the dirty work, so to speak. So they've got it a little easy because they're following behind us, and they'll continue to follow behind us until they go ahead and make the commitment. They want to go ahead and explore the universe the way we have. With their own telescopes, with their own, you know, Mars rover, with their own with their own other tools to explore the solar system and beyond. So they've got to decide to make that commitment. Will they? That remains to be seen. I'd like to hear what you guys think out there, too. So if you want to go ahead and drop us a line, by all means, please do. That is mailbag at talkingspaceonline.com. Write us an email. Send us an MP3. Let us know what you think on the topic. Kind of interested to hear about that.
Honestly, me too. Alrighty then. So, next it goes over to Mark, and he's got some more out-of-this-world stuff for us. Mark?
How about going to Mars with Maven? Now, this may be another story or another thing that, in my case, I've heard about it, you know, just maybe a headline or a short tag description of it, never really thought about it. But somehow I decided to look at it a little bit closer, knowing that, gee, I needed to look at this, and I hope it's not too late. Well, first of all, what Maven is all about, it's a satellite that will be launching to Mars in the latter part of 2013. It's going to orbit Mars and explore the planet's upper atmosphere, the ionosphere, and the interactions of the atmosphere with the sun and solar wind. MAVEN stands for Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution Mission. Now, how can you go to Mars with MAVEN? Well, you simply go to the website, you create a simple login, and you put your name down. And your name will be placed on a DVD, and it will go to Mars. I think that's kind of fun. So, taking the liberty that the rest of the Talking Space podcast team would go along with it, I submitted just that as a name that needed to go to Mars. So in spite of all my grouchiness about the moon and the Mars and asteroids on a recent show, I'm kind of downright upbeat about the fact that Talking Space is going to go to Mars. You can also, there's a contest. Now, here's the tough part. This ends July 1st, so there's only a few days, literally, to go to the website and put your name in. But you can also put in a poem. Now, they ask that it be in the form of a haiku poem. They will be voted on by the public, and the top three popular entries will be sent to Mars on board the spacecraft. They'll be prominently displayed also on the MAVEN website. But I think this is fun. Told some friends about it. Got some kids excited. They're going to go to Mars, too. I suggested that maybe the whole family could put their names in, and they would be maybe the first family to go to Mars. And one thing I discovered in the process of making a login is that once you create a login, you can put several names in and restart the process to add another name. You don't have to have a separate login for each individual that you might want to send if you have others in your family that would like to have their name go to Mars. So I thought that was kind of fun. If you look up MAVEN, M-A-V-E-N, and Going to Mars, it should take you to their website, which is a colorado.edu website.
If I remember correctly, this is not the first time that they've actually done something like this, where you were able to put your name on a DVD and send it to Mars. If I remember correctly, did they not do this with, it was either an orbiter or maybe the rover Spirit and Opportunity?
Spirit and Opportunity have the same thing, Sawyer, and I think so, and correct me, somebody's out there going to correct me on this one. I think MSL also has
yes.
Some sort of public outreach as well.
Yeah, and that's the recent one that I remember was that as well with Curiosity.
And just as an aside, real quick, you know, for speaking about little things and so on, there's a Steve Squires arranged also to have a small shard from the World Trade Center placed on both of the robotic rovers. So there is a piece of the World Trade Center sitting on Mars, which I thought was kind of cool.
Yes, indeed. And feel free to get your name on there and submit an awesome haiku, and hopefully we'll see your name on Mars.
Yep, and I know my nephew's name is on there, and there's some other, I know I'm on there, and a few other folks I know My niece's name is on there. So again, it's, as Mark pointed out, it's a great, if you really have young ones, I mean really young ones, like, you know, that are in kindergarten or still doing show and tell, this is like tailor-made for that. So, you know, imagine a young child going in there in front of a kindergarten class and say he's, well, virtually going to Mars. Just picture that for a sec. That is just too cool.
Oh, yeah. And as Mark said, all of our names are on there, so feel free to join us. Alrighty then. So now we move on to our final trip around the table. And while we're talking about sending our names places, what about out of the solar system, into the universe? What about maybe 17.6 light years away? And not just your name, but a picture, a message. What would you say to an extraterrestrial if you could send him a message? Well, there's a company that's giving you the chance. No longer do you need to deal with SETI to try and just sit and listen for extraterrestrial life. Lone Signal is the name of the company, and they are going to be sending out a continuous crowdsourced message to the target of Gliese 526, which their website has the exact location in the sky as well as some other information about it. But basically what you do is you go onto the website, you log in, and then you write up a message, and it gets put in a queue. And then when it's your turn, the signal is then sent out from their main broadcasting antenna, which is from the Jamesburg Earth Station in Carmel Valley, California. So basically, they're sending it out from there, and the message they're sending out is you. When I think of this, all I could think of is some of the other messages in the past that we've beamed out into the solar system. And I specifically think a lot of Carl Sagan and another very famous image that we sent out to try and represent what we are. But who needs an image when you can send messages like, and this is an actual message, are Mondays just this long as well where you're from? Beam me home. So some of them are silly, but some of them are genuine and sincere, and some of them are in any language you could think of. I've seen English, I've seen French, I've seen binary, and more. So it's a really interesting project. What do you think of it?
That is kind of cool. It's very, very reminiscent of the sort of messages in a bottle that we threw out on Pioneer 10 and 11 and on Voyager 1 and 2. Pioneer 10 and 11 on their main bus have got a plaque that was designed by Dr. Carl Sagan. And on Voyager 1 and 2, or basically the infamous LP, or the record albums, the gold record albums that are on their way to wherever they're going to go after Voyager 1 and 2 become just simply stray derelicts. So, and this also too is just kind of sort of leaving our calling card out there in the void and letting people know that there are living things that exist, I don't know, some 93 million miles away from a humdrum star in a quadrant of the galaxy. So it's kind of exciting, you know. And if you've ever wanted to go ahead and leave your mark that's saying you were here and send it out there into the void, here's your chance. I mean, this is kind of a cool project.
Exactly. The first signal went out on June 18th, but like we mentioned, this is a continuous stream as long as their relay station is up and running. So you can still submit, and there's still a whole bunch lined up in the queue to go out. So definitely feel free to join them, and we'll see if we can get somebody on to talk a little bit more about this sometime in the near future, because I think this is a cool project.
So, Sawyer, if we were interested in submitting something, how would we go about doing it?
Right on their website, which is lonesignal.com.
Cool.
And all you have to do is click sign up to transmit your free message and send it out beyond the world. Not send your message to the world, but send it beyond to another world. Alrighty then. Now to finish things off, Gene, I know you're going to make me hungry. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is kind of sweet, no pun intended. A friend of mine Maria Votazzi brought this little project to my attention, and I just thought I'd mention it in passing. It was proudly displayed on the Albert Einstein ATV4 blog that that ESA has on their website, and it was the article here is entitled "Good Chocolate for a Good Cause," and it describes how on board ATV4, along with some supplies and so on, and experiment packages that the astronauts need, and so on and so forth, well, there are 12 bars of chocolate. And this is just not any ordinary chocolate. It is from a company called Plant for the Planet. And this little foundation here managed to go ahead and put 12 bars on board ATV4. It's called Change Chocolate, according to the website here. It's basically it's chocolate with a purpose, they call it. Now, according to the website, quote, Change Chocolate dealers and producers give up their profits to Plant for the Planet as a charity. They use the money to plant so many trees the production of each bar. So it kind of neutralizes the production of each bar of chocolate. So essentially the bar, or producing the bar, is kind of climate neutral. So you plant a tree and it you know, hopefully cleans up the environment and so on. So it's kind of chocolate for a purpose. They are on Twitter. Their Twitter ID is at PFTP_INT. Or their website is IntoTheChocosphere.org. So if you're interested in learning more about what they're doing and what kind of makes us all, what the chocolate's all about, go ahead and take a look at this. And again, we'll put the link on the ESA website on the show notes. But it's kind of a neat little project.
You indeed succeeded at making me hungry. Thank you. It's a great idea. I mean, if you're on the space station, chocolate doesn't stay dehydrated too well. So, I mean, it's great to always get some fresh chocolate. And not only giving it to people in space, but helping the planet back here on Earth doesn't get much better.
And I'm positive by now those chocolate bars are probably histoire.
Yeah, if they're not gone by now, they can send them to me. I'll finish them. Speaking of finishing them, with that, I believe that brings this episode to its conclusion. I'd like to thank everybody who joined us here tonight. Thank you for joining us, Gene McCulka.
Real quick plug, since we have a big aviation-related show here today, we had a couple of good aviation articles. Take a look at, listen to a friend of mine who runs the Aviation Extended podcast. If you want to go ahead and take a listen, that's Aviation-Extended, extended.co.uk. We've kind of plugged them on the show before. And stay tuned. If you're listening to us on Astronomy FM, there's some really good stuff coming your way.
Yes, indeed. And thank you as well for joining us, Mark Raderman.
Another interesting show. I hope our sound was better this time. If not, we'll get it right one of these days. I promise.
Exactly. There's a couple little warbles in there, but I think overall we're back to our regular show quality. And just in time, because we've got a great show for you next week. Because keep in mind, this weekend is the opening of the Space Shuttle Atlantis exhibit, and Mark Raderman and myself will be down at the Kennedy Space Center covering the entire event. So we'll be back next week with bits and bytes and sound and pictures for the website and a whole slew of stories and probably some shed tears as well, but we'll get to that next week, and we hope you'll join us then. But until then, as always, have a great day, night, evening, or whatever it may be, where you are.